there, it's Angela, and I'm so glad you found your way here to architecting. Creative careers can be stressful, and it's hard to be vulnerable, but this is your landing pad for raw honesty. I'll help you get clarity, reconnect with your passion, and have the career of your dreams. If you're ready to make a difference, have an impact, and say bye-bye to burnout, stick with me, and let's get architecting. Hey, Bright Lights, welcome to Architecting. I'm your host, Angela Mazzi. Welcome back. If you are a returning listener, whoop, whoop, we love having you in our community. If you are a new listener, I'm so glad that you're here on this journey with me. My goal is to provide you with the resources you need to have the most impact possible in your career. Together, we are stronger when we can reframe some of the bias that exists in creative careers. We can empower ourselves to do better work in less time without all of the stress, overwhelm, and burnout. And I do have one ask. Please subscribe to the podcast wherever you are listening. When you subscribe, you tell the algorithm that this is a show worth showing to other people, and you help us to have a broader reach and build a bigger coalition so we can make even more of a difference. We know we need it. Just today, I saw on LinkedIn where a colleague had posted that he was taking a sabbatical, resigning from a major leadership role in his firm just because he needed that break. And he's not sure what his next move is going to be. Could it be leaving the industry? We can't afford to lose our best thinkers because they're too burned out. That is part of my mission with architecting. And if you support this, if you also want to help end the toxic way that our industry works, please help this show have a broader audience by subscribing. Today, we're going to talk about a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, and that is negative bias. Why we have it, how it holds us back, how to catch ourselves when we do it, because it really is part of our factory setting as a human being to default to negative bias, and why that's going to help you really add rocket fuel, not only to your career, but to your life, to the quality of every relationship that you have. And I'm going to start with a story because you know that I do these podcasts in real time. I do not batch record. So when I'm bringing you a topic, it's because it's coming forward in my own life or the life of someone I know. One of you or one of my clients has brought it forward as a topic. This one really hit home for me. I have a 17-year-old son who's a junior in high school. And we've been having some struggles lately taking acne medication that's been prescribed to him. He's had this problem with acne for about a year now, and we've tried different over-the-counter treatments. Nothing was working. Talked to his doctor, who referred him to a dermatologist. Big eye roll moment because he didn't think he needed to go. He didn't think any of this was a problem. The dermatologist prescribes pills as well as two topical treatments, one for the morning, one for the evening. Spends quite a bit of time talking with him about how important it is to use the medications every single day and that this is how she can tell whether or not they're going to make a difference or whether she needs to make adjustments and why it does matter that this acne get cleared up, that it's not just about what it looks like, but it's about other effects that it can have. So, of course, I remind him every morning to take his pill and to put the topical stuff on, and I try to remind him at night before he goes to bed. Fast forward to last Monday morning, I grab the bottle of pills, and it feels a little bit full. So I open them up, and there's no way He's been taking these for almost a month because there's only supposed to be 30 in the bottle. So I count them and there are 23 left, which means that most days he is lying about taking his medicine and he's not taking it. What do? I do what most over-functioning, stressed-out parents these days would do. I sit him down and we have a whole conversation about it. And I tell him that now I'm going to watch him take it every day. And I'm going to watch him put the topical treatment on. He, of course, is glaring at me, not happy, but I feel like, what else can I do? We've had the reasonable conversation about why it matters. He had agreed with the doctor that he would do everything every day, and he's not doing it. So we go through that, and the next day we go through that, and the third day, I wake up, and he's not in his room, and I think, oh, he got up early. But I can't find him. He's not answering when I call him. And I notice that his backpack and his shoes and his coat are gone. And I'm like, where did he go? Trying to text him and call him and I can't reach him. Don't know where he is. Wake up my daughter, ask her if she's heard from him or knows what he's up to. She doesn't know. We're both trying to reach him. And finally, he responds. I'm sitting outside. So he had gotten up early, gotten ready for school, and gone and parked himself on the porch glider because he was mad at me. And we had this whole conversation about why that wasn't an okay thing to do. And turns out he is mad at me because he doesn't want me micromanaging him. Doesn't like that, doesn't like it that I got upset with him, doesn't like it that I pointed out where he was not doing what he agreed to do. We have a whole conversation about that, send him on his way to school, and about half hour, 45 minutes later, he comes back home soaking wet because it was pouring down rain. I'm like, what are you doing home? Well, today is a testing day and I don't have tests in the morning, so I left my stuff with a friend and I came back home because I wanted to apologize to you. Oh, my heart. And this just shows you how he really is a good kid, but he's got his quirks. As much as I love to brag on what a creative genius he really is and all of the things that he accomplishes all of the time, this kid on his own wrote a book. He composes and arranges music. He's in all these extracurricular things. He has all these leadership roles. He's on track to be an Eagle Scout. So much here to be proud of. And I do tell him, and I do celebrate him, but what he notices is when I focus on what he's not doing right instead of what he is. That is a real lesson learned in negative bias and how it doesn't serve us. As human beings, we are hardwired to look for what's going wrong, not what's going right, as a survival mechanism. So it's built into our evolutionary structure to do this. And the reason is the things that are going right are not a threat to our lives. It's the things that could go wrong. It's the things we can't trust that are deceptive, that might lure us in, that are dangerous. Of course, in our lives, we're going to be predisposed to question things, to doubt, to find fault, and to focus on fixing what's wrong. Imagine that you are managing the sewer district and you've got monitors on pipes all over the city. The ones that are clear, you're not going to worry about. They're doing their job. The ones that are clogging up, though, are the ones that need your attention because that's a problem. And that's a problem that could have very catastrophic consequences if you don't fix it. You've only got so much energy. Where are you going to put your energy? You're going to put your energy toward the problem, towards fixing what isn't performing optimally. You're not going to worry about the stuff that's doing just fine, or maybe even performing better than expected because it's not an imminent threat. That all seems logical enough, and I'm sure if you have kids, you have found yourself in the exact same position as I am. The things that we get on their case about are usually the little things. There may be 10 to 20% of everything they're doing because we're worried about fixing the things that are wrong. But today I want to challenge you to flip the script on this, because if we really want to live that more elevated existence, we can't be focused on the problems. Here's why. When we're focused on the problems, we're focused on lack, we're focused on what we don't have, we're consumed with the struggle. We are essentially, in some form or another, not feeling safe. If it's a problem with your kids, you don't feel safe because you may have failed them if you don't do a good job of helping them be their best selves. Or you may fear being judged by other people about how good of a parent you are. If it's related to something that you're doing at work, you're focusing on what's going wrong, where the team isn't performing, or mistakes were made, because you're worried that you're not going to be able to deliver what was promised, or that the quality will be lacking, or that the client will be upset with you. Think about all the ways that we can reduce whatever the negative thing is that we're focused on down to fear, down to that evolutionary hardwiring to survive. Fear is a stress response. Things that we are afraid of are dangerous and they can hurt us. In the modern world, though, so much of the things that we interpret as fear and that therefore cause us stress are not actually physical dangers. And even though you might say, but Angela, if I lost my job, be a little bit of a problem, that would be a little bit of an issue for my survival. How am I going to pay my bills? What am I going to do next? But it's a different kind of survival. The stress response evolved to keep you out of physical danger, not out of employment danger. And the stress response is actually shutting down your ability to do the very things you need to do to be out of the kind of danger, quote unquote, that we face today. So let's break these down one by one. If we're afraid that other people are going to judge us, that means that we're not taking the opportunity to connect with them, to understand what they really value and why. Maybe they don't care about things that we're assuming they care about. Maybe we're projecting onto them. And even if they do care, we can't be everything to everyone. When we're afraid to be vulnerable in front of someone, we're basically letting who they are and whatever judgments they bring impact what we do, which means we're not showing up as our authentic selves. Even if we do make them happy, we've made them happy for the wrong reason, and they haven't connected with us where we really can bring value. We've created a certain duplicity in that relationship that we've now got to put energy into continuing in order to go on. If we're afraid that we'll look bad because of someone else's performance or someone else's outcome, like I did with my son and you may do with your children or people that you are helping to lead or supervise, you're taking away that person's opportunity to grow and evolve when you try to step in and control. because you cannot control anyone but yourself. What you think you're saving them from might be a critical experience they need to have in their growth, and you are denying them that opportunity. You're also assuming that they aren't capable of figuring things out. You're not giving them the trust and the grace to make mistakes, learn from mistakes, do better. There's a very big difference between saying, I'm here as your sounding board, I'm here to support you, and I will intervene and micromanage you so that you can't make mistakes. And in those situations, it's really worth having the conversation about how can we do better? Not what we did wrong, but how someone could do better. We spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about unwinding that stigma of failure. Failure is how we learn, that failure doesn't mean that you shouldn't try again. It is not a sign from the universe that you were never meant to do this thing. All this work that we're doing is to undo what someone who micromanaged us did to us. They made the price of failure too high. Failure cost us their trust, their good graces. Failure came with very harsh consequences. So it became something we feared. And if we're doing all this work to overcome all of those limiting beliefs about failure, why would we perpetuate them in the way we treat other people? If failure really is okay, if failure really is part of how we learn and grow, we gotta stop taking someone else's failure personally and help them learn how to fail forward, not how to fail catastrophically. And that is a conversation that I had with my son. And is he 100% better? No, he still forgets to take his medication, but he's becoming more aware. And we have to recognize that it's a process. And when we celebrate someone for what they're doing right, we motivate them to do more of it. When we make someone wrong, we trigger that anger, guilt, and shame response, which most of the time doesn't motivate them to do better. It makes them feel like they can't do it. So we take away their agency. We also take away their self-efficacy, focusing on the lack, the fear, instead of focusing on where we have power and where we actually can have control. And the last way that we experience this negative bias is in our own fear of failure. We talked about failure a little bit in terms of other people's judgment of us or someone that we felt responsible failing being a reflection on us. It's also just when you were so sure you knew what you were doing and things didn't turn out the way you wanted them to. And it's very, very easy in those moments to feel ashamed, like a victim, very much like we need to hide or sugarcoat what happened. And we take our failure as a sign that we should never, ever, ever take a risk again. So we start to become very risk adverse because we want to get the win, even though the win may not be serving us or leading us to what we really want to be doing. We just want to get the gold star for the day. It's not going to get us work in our zone of genius. It's not going to really impress people if that was what we were trying to do anyway. So how do we flip the switch on all of this? We do it by focusing on what we do have and what we want and where we're making progress. If you feel judged by someone, first of all, check in with yourself. Is this real or is this a story in your head? And if it's a story in your head, then you need to think about why you're projecting onto another person and using that as a way to hold yourself back? Would they really feel this way? Or are you just making a lot of assumptions? If someone has actually expressed a negative opinion of something that you're doing or skepticism, instead of internalizing it and going down the anger, guilt, shame spiral, you need to call a timeout there and you need to ask more questions so you can thank them for their insights and you can ask them a little bit more about why they feel that way or what advice they would have or explain why it's important to you and ask them for insights on how to avoid some of the pitfalls that they're worried about. Maybe even ask them to help you or ask if they have ways that they would do it better. You can flip that around when you aren't so focused on yourself and how you're being perceived, but instead are making the thing that you want to accomplish the star of the show, not you. If it's an outcome based on somebody else and how they're performing or not performing, you need to have a conversation with them. We can't push people to go where they don't want to go. We can't assume that we know best all of the time. So this is the chance to have that real conversation about what do you want and why do you want it? And are we assuming that you want certain things in your career or in your life or out of your day that don't really matter to you or that won't really make you happy? So we need to recalibrate expectations, or we need to work in a different way, or we need to think about if you're even in the right career. If you can ask the person about motivations, you can tune in to what they really want for themselves. Then you can work with them at a whole different level. The story with my son, he actually takes a lot of pride in his music work and his professionalism, both in terms of the quality of his work, the attention and the focus that he brings to a performance, and to his appearance. He will dress up in a suit and tie when no one else will because it matters that much to him to be professional. So we talked about why that matters and how that could then translate to other parts of his life where he could be just as professional. Finally, if you're worried about your own failure, if you are afraid to even start something because you're afraid you won't be good at it, or you worry about the consequences of a failure, to turn that around, you need to think about where you want to go more than how you can stay where you are. You need to think about the resources that you need to do something and to ask for those resources. You need to realize that failures are learning opportunities and to be grateful for what you've learned. Probably heard the phrase, things don't happen to you, they happen for you. And when you look at what you can learn from an outcome that might not have been the outcome you wanted, then you can start to see how you can recalibrate. Recalibrate can mean trying in a different way. Recalibrate can mean putting different resources into play. Or recalibrating can mean walking away from something. Which one is the right answer is going to be based on what you learned. Thanks for listening. If you want even more content, head on over to architectingpodcast.com and subscribe to my newsletter and get some great free downloads while you're there. Be sure to follow me on social media, on Instagram at Architecting Podcast, Facebook and LinkedIn pages are Architecting, and the YouTube channel, Architecting Podcast. Stay inspired.